everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Was the Law of God Abolished when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? If your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client. Or your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? My common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Professor, Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed, and it's worse than that. He said most students graduate from this law school, the fourth largest law school in the nation, Hastings, graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of someone who's in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate from this law school without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about the law of God, the Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments primarily, but not only the Ten Commandments. Did you know that there are 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments in the Scripture? Sometimes people say, oh no, Gordon, you're wrong. The Jews counted them up and there's 613. That's nothing personal. Nothing personal. I don't know how those boys count. Maybe they've been to public school, but I counted 759. I wrote a book, a great big thick book called The Mosaic Law, and I can count 759. And they're organized, and they're organized into a very simple, very expeditious system, just like the United States Code. There's 133 subject matters, or 133 titles of law. Now, the U.S. Code has 50 titles, 50 subject matters that it covers. The law of God has 133. If you look up adultery, for instance, you'll find all the statutes in the Mosaic Law that concern adultery, sex crimes. You know, it could be sodomy or bestiality, or it could be marriage and a divorce and things like that. Very simple, straightforward system. And the law only contains 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. Do you know that that's only about a third the number that you'll find in your state traffic code? Your state traffic code has more statutes, more do's and don'ts, than the entire law of God, and God runs the entire universe on this system of law. Now, it's a complete system, and it covers everything that human beings get involved in. It covers torts and contracts and negligence. It covers wrongful death and so on. There's everything that you need. In fact, he was so concerned, so himself believed that it was so complete that he wrote two statutes and said, don't change it. Two statutes. They're in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32. It says, don't change this law. And he said, don't change a jot and don't change a tittle of it. That's how complete it is. Works perfectly. Now, of course, we didn't believe him, and we came along and said, no, we got to have a king. We've got to have a parliament. We've got to have a legislature. We have to have a Congress. We have to elect lawmakers like Dianne Feinstein to go to Washington with Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter to make new laws. And we have 2.5 million here in the United States. Boy, we've got plenty now, don't we? I mean, there isn't anything in this country that I can think of that you can do that isn't covered by some law. Hell, you can't even park your car, for crying out loud, without having some kind of a law that directs how much money you put in the parking meter, or where you park, or how you park, and why you park. And if you don't park correctly, some guy comes along, gives you a ticket, takes your car away from you, locks it up, holds it off. You got to bail it out of an impound, go to court, and go through all this hassle. And that's just for parking your crummy car, for crying out loud. So we've got plenty of laws here. Americans love law. I mean, we just get into it up to our elbows and kind of wallow and squeeze it through our fingers, and we just love it, don't we? Now, I get letters here from time to time from people, and the last time on the air I mentioned to you that Christians are criminals. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm down on Christians. 95% of Americans are Christians. That's what they tell you. Furthermore, my Aunt Bessie was a Christian. All of my relatives are Christians, and all of my business associates and friends are Christians. I'm not opposed to Christians. Not at all. I'm not opposed to Jews. I'm not opposed to Muslims. But I like to point out that these people are criminals. These people are religious, but they don't practice law. And the basic problem here in America isn't our religions. The basic problem in America, it's our law. We don't practice the right law. We've got lots of laws to practice, and people are real concerned about buckling their seatbelt and driving 55 and registering their cars. They don't think anything at all about going out here and having sex with some strange woman, which has a whole lot longer and more long-lasting repercussions and penalties that are associated with it. It reminds me of these country western songs. Have you ever listened to a country western song? Pay attention next time. I kind of hate them myself. I don't like country music, but you know, you're listening to this country song, and the guy's he's sitting there and he's down at the Blue Room, sitting on a bar stool, crying in his beer, and he says, "Oh, my girl Mabel, she ran off with my best friend Joe." Or, you know, if it's a female singer, she's singing about, "Oh, my best friend Mabel, she ran off with my man Bill." Always talking about somebody running off of somebody else. The songs are almost invariably about adultery, infidelity. And they're always sad and morose and, "Oh, I'm just feeling real bad and I'm about ready to blow my brains out," and blah, blah, blah. What you're really dealing with here is broken law. If these people were to obey the law that said thou shalt not commit adultery, and if they had marriages and dowries and bride price, and they took marriage as a business, and they looked at Proverbs chapter 31, and women were prepared for marriage instead of being prepared for sex. I mean, America's girls are prepared to work in Flo's whorehouse. They dress like whores. They look like whores. They act like whores. And then when you rape one of them, they get just mad as hell. I don't know. Doesn't make any sense to me, but then, you know, that's the way Americans are. So don't think that I'm down on Christians per se. Not at all. What I'm down on is lawlessness and crime, because it produces bad results. Whether you're a Christian, a Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim, or somebody else, when you go out here and break a law, there's a penalty to pay. And in the civil law, they don't care whether or not you're a Catholic, Protestant, or Jew. When you break the law, they wanna fine you. They wanna punish you. They wanna put you in prison. Same thing happens here with biblical law. Except that biblical law is enforced automatically. You see, you don't have some guy down here at Flo's Whorehouse to give you a ticket when you come out. You've got little microbes called AIDS, herpes, and VD that enforce the law. They're automatic. They just occur. And then somebody come up with penicillin, you know, and they said, aha, we can sell forgiveness of sin now. You can go down to Flo's and have a good time on Friday night. Then if you come out with syphilis, we can cure that syphilis, because I'm Marcus Welby, MD, and I can sell forgiveness of sin down at Mercy Medical Center. So we have a system of lawlessness that is enforced by and abetted by a system, a medical system over here, that helps us to commit more and more crimes. And then we learn this from the time we're little children. We get radar detectors. We're careful to go get a driver's license and then sign the driver's license, which is your agreement with the state that you'll obey all the traffic laws. And then we go down to Radio Shack and get a fuzz buster, put it on the dashboard so that we can find a place that we can drive 110 miles an hour and we can read the radar signal from way up the road so that we can slow down, drive by the cop, and then speed up and drive 110 again. We have made in America this thing of lawlessness and criminal behavior a science. Hell, it's a part and parcel with our commerce, for crying out loud. Every once in a while I get a letter from a listener, and the letter from the listener will tell me the results of sin, but they don't actually say, gee, I was out sinning and I broke a law and I'm paying a penalty now. I've never received a letter like that, but once in a while somebody sends me a letter. In fact, about once a week, which is about 50 letters a year. And some of them are kind of heartrending. I got a letter here. I thought I'd share it with you on this program. This lady's name is Teresa. I don't know where she's from. I don't think she said, and it's really not that important. But Teresa's husband was killed recently, and Teresa now is a new widow. And she wrote me a letter, and she wanted to know if I could help her. So let me read you the letter, and then I want to take the letter apart, and I'm going to analyze it for you, and I'm going to show you, as I did on the last program, what would happen if Teresa obeyed the law of God? She didn't, she doesn't, and she probably isn't going to. But what if she did? Would the results, would there be some changes made in her life for the better if she changed her lifestyle? Let's take a look. She starts off by saying, hello, Mr. Gordon. My name is Teresa. My husband of 22 and a half years was killed in Baghdad. And I would like to speak to you on this concerning his death and how it happened. Now, I currently have an attorney on retainer. However, he tells me that I really do not have a case. The accident has witnesses that would gladly testify on our behalf. But unless someone is willing to help me go all the way, I feel helpless. And although my attorney is still trying to help me, my husband actually died in a Baghdad hospital. My telephone number is, and my email address is, and I have documentation of the events surrounding the entire thing. It was neglect on the part of Halliburton, not war-related. I was even given a sum of $50,000 at the family viewing night by one of Halliburton's spokesmen. Now I have received a 1099 form to pay taxes on this money. Being a widow, now I have no means of paying very much of anything out. I did not even receive the correct amount of widow's benefits that I should have. They just came up with a figure, and that's what I get monthly. Could you help me? My attorney tells me, KBR's attorneys will not return his phone calls, and yet when I call one of them, they always seem to be there, and I actually speak to one of their attorneys. With deepest respect, sincerely, Teresa. All right, now that was the first letter. Now, the reason I bring this up is because, first of all, Teresa needs an answer, and this is a good way for me to answer rather than get on the typewriter here and bang out a long-winded type letter. That's number one. But then number two, it's of great value in my view to take a letter like this and run through it and analyze it so that, you know, all the rest of you listeners out there can take a look at the cause and effect relationship of what happens to one person when there are broken laws. Laws that, had they been followed, would have produced a different result. Now, I'm not here to tell Teresa you made all these bad mistakes and it serves you right. I'm just here to tell you that, gee, if we'd have handled this a little bit differently, we might have had a different outcome. And what are we going to do for the future? What are the rest of you listeners going to do to alleviate this very same problem if it comes up in your life? Let's see if we can take a look at her second letter. She says, my husband was killed in Baghdad March 25th, 2005, working for KBR Halliburton out of Houston, Texas. He was hired as a carpenter supervisor, and at the time of his death, he was working the night shift with the company, which the company required all employees to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. My husband's name was Gene, and he was only 47. The night of the incident, he was working and came upon a water filtration system called a Ro-Pew system, and he noticed water coming from one of the gauges and radioed to his supervisor and notified him of the problem. He was told to turn off the system. Now, you have to understand, this was a water system that required a skilled, certified person to handle, not a carpenter. As instructed, my husband turned off the valve. In doing so, the water tank that was overflowing and designed to only get to 4 to 6 feet high and only hold 25,000 gallons of water was actually filled to 80,000 gallons and was more than 10 feet in height. Sounds like a bladder system to me. The person responsible for this tank had fallen asleep and on his watch and was not more than a few feet from his post in the next room. Well, the tank exploded on my husband, ripping through the back of his head, causing a gash in the back of his head from ear to ear, digging into his brain, thus bringing on a severe stroke throughout his brain and many contusions deeply in the skull, and also the rubber from the water bladder ripped out a piece of his heart, a lung, shattered one leg into splinters, and pushing his pelvic bone through his back, breaking his spine. KBR people were instructed to keep this from the CID military police. However, one brave young man that was there at the time of the accident went to the criminal investigation division on his own and was fired from his position immediately. He obtained an attorney, and almost after 1 year, he finally got his job back. Now, I have the same attorney, and so far, all this has gotten me are more bills to pay. And I'm asking if you may know of any way that I can take out a lawsuit against the people responsible for the death of my husband. The family viewing of my husband's body, Halliburton sent some people in. One of the men presented me a check for $50,000, assuring me that I would not have to pay taxes on this money. But now I've received a 1099 and will have to pay taxes after all. What can I do? I am now a widow after 23 years of marriage, and I cannot even get a Social Security income until I turn 50. I am receiving a small widow's benefit that KBR pulled an amount out of thin air to decide to pay me. Could you please tell me if I can legally sue KBR, which is in the process of pulling away from Halliburton? My attorney tells me I really do not have a case. However, I'm still paying him. Help if you can, please. Sincerely, scared and broke in North Carolina. So we know that Teresa's from North Carolina. Well, I'll tell you, there's a couple of three things here that I noted down, and so I took my notes and I analyzed this letter, and keep in mind now that I receive a letter like this probably once a week, 52 letters a year, in all probability. I don't keep exact tabs on these kinds of letters, but I'm also a general contractor, so let me tell you, as an old man, I came to a conclusion years ago that I could get more bang for the buck by teaching somebody else how to do something for themselves than I could if I actually went out and did something. So you notice that Teresa says, well, can you help me? Well, you bet I can, Teresa. Yeah, you bet I can. I've been helping thousands of people for many, many years, 20 years plus. I've been operating a law school. But in a little different way than perhaps you're used to. Let me explain. Remember Hurricane Katrina? Well, after Hurricane Katrina, there are thousands of volunteers who have gone down to help those people down there rebuild their houses, rebuild the infrastructure down there, and that's good. And those people need thousands of volunteers to go help them. But the other day I was up here, I'm building a little shed up here for the wife to store some things in, and I'm pushing 70 now, and I noticed that I'm getting kind of old. And if I went down to build houses for people down there in the Gulf, and I'm pretty good, you know, I'm a pretty good carpenter, fair to middling anyway. But you know, if I went to work on a construction job, I wouldn't last till noon. Not because my work is bad, because I'm too old and too slow. Too old and slow. And because of that, if I went out on a construction job, you know, with all the young men out there, I noticed that when I get down, I was up putting some roof rafters up, and when I get down on one knee, you know, to nail a rafter in, and you gotta walk around, I don't work off of a ladder like I did 20, 30 years ago. And I gotta have it staged now. And I gotta work off of a scaffold. Well, you know, young men don't work off scaffolds. They work off of ladders, and they walk around on the rafters themselves and walk the purlons, and I just can't do that anymore, see? So I think that I would be of greater service and greater help if I were to teach the young men who are not carpenters how to cut straight lines, how to read a tape measure, and how to cut angles, and how to cut bird's mouths and things like that, that would help the young men who could go out and actually do some useful, productive, and meaningful work. And that's why I opened a law school. Now, I could join the legal practice, but there's no shortage of lawyers in America. There's no shortage of lawyers here, Teresa. There's plenty of them. You've got one. Now, how good this lawyer is, that may be up for debate. I don't know how good the guy is. Our Chief Justice back in 1978, Warren Burger, said 90% of them are incompetent. And the reason that you wrote me this letter is because you're complaining about your lawyer. You believe that your lawyer is incompetent. If you believed that your lawyer was competent, you would have accepted his advice when he said you don't have a case. You didn't accept his advice and you wrote me a letter. At least you want a second opinion, which is pretty good on your part. Pretty sound reasoning. You know, you go to one doctor and he says, let's cut out your liver and give you a liver transplant, and you go to a second doctor to see if there's maybe some other way that we could deal with this problem. The liver transplant doctor wants to sell transplants, and a holistic doctor might say, well, we want to rebuild the liver that you've got. And it gives you a choice. So that's good thinking, I would say, on your part. Now, I need to explain to all of you out there that I'm not licensed as a lawyer in North Carolina. So if you wanted me to help you as a lawyer, you want me to come in and take your case, it means I got to go to North Carolina, and I got to pass the bar exam, and I got to go to work in North Carolina. Or, in all likelihood, since Halliburton is a multinational corporation, we'd sue them in federal court. And we could sue them in federal court, but we don't know where that court's going to be, do we? Should I sue him here in Springfield, Missouri, North Carolina, or should I sue him in Oklahoma or Houston, Texas? Now, in your letter here, you gave us a lot of information, and Unfortunately, the information that you put in your letter is not the kind of information that we need to make a determination or to answer most of your questions. That's the problem. And that's understandable because you're not a lawyer, and so you don't know what the right questions are going to be or what the right information is going to be. This is why I opened a law school years ago. I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach lay people law. I'm going to teach people just like Teresa and Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. I'm going to teach those people the law and show them how to use the law and how to make determinations. Because you see, from the letter you wrote, Teresa, I don't know if you have a case or not. Your lawyer says you don't have a case. I would presume that he has seen the actual contract that your husband signed at Halliburton before he went to Baghdad. And that contract is going to be the governing document. You say he was working for Halliburton. In your letter, you indicate that he's an employee. My experience with these multinational corporations working in overseas jobs is that your husband was not an employee, but that he was an independent contractor. And that he holds independent contractor status and isn't covered by workman's compensation, social security, unemployment insurance, and so on. I don't know. I didn't read the contract. I don't have it. Your lawyer does. Now, I also am familiar with this scenario that oftentimes comes down. Your lawyer, the guy that you hired, is a professional, and he's an entrepreneur. He's a businessman. He's in business for himself. He's a self-employed contractor. And as a self-employed contractor, your lawyer is trying to make as much money off of this case as he possibly can. Now let me tell you a little story about lawyers, crooked lawyers, lawyers that are kind of unethical. But it's not illegal. I mean, they may be kind of crooked and they may be kind of unethical, but that doesn't mean that they're breaking any laws. And they take advantage of the circumstance. They take advantage of the ignorance of people, which isn't against the law. Bankers do it all the time. You know, you come into the bank and you sign a mortgage contract on your house. The banker doesn't explain to you geometric progression. He doesn't sit there and explain interest and usury to you. The presumption is you're educated. You went to school. You went to college. And you're an educated person and you know what you're doing. And this is a product that the banker is selling and that you want to buy it. Now, Halliburton, like any other multinational corporation, has a bushel basket of lawyers working in their legal department writing up the contracts for your husband and thousands of other people who are going to work in Iraq or Iran or Saudi Arabia or anyplace else. And those contracts are going to be written from the perspective and for the benefit of Halliburton, not for the people who are signing the contracts and working for Halliburton. That's point number one you have to understand. That your husband did not write the contract. It was an adhesion contract, and Halliburton wrote the contract to cover just such contingencies as this. What if we're negligent, and what if this guy gets killed? What if this guy gets killed in the war? What if some guy kidnaps this guy and hauls him off and cuts his head off or. Now you've heard of the atrocities that go on over there. You understand full well that Baghdad is probably not as safe as Durham, North Carolina. Probably. I don't know how dangerous it is over there. I remember as a young man they used to do this. You could get a job working on the dew line painting up in Alaska. And in those days, they paid you $16 an hour. My God, those were the days when a man worked for $3 an hour. Can you imagine getting paid $16 an hour? Five times what you could make down here stateside. Or you could go off and work on a military project over in Guam or in the Canal Zone working for a multinational corporation, you know, like Guy F. Atkinson or somebody. And those jobs paid a lot of money. But when you sign on to those jobs, like working on the north slope of Alaska, you sign on and you work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you do that for 6 weeks on. And then you get 6 weeks off. So it's 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. At least that's, you know, when I was a kid, that's what they did. And you get 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. And it's a hell of a deal. And they give you free airfare. I mean, they fly you to Anchorage, Alaska, and they fly you back home, and you're making five times as much money as you could out here on another job. Now, of course, these are the kinds of jobs where nobody in his right mind wants to work. Now, your husband took this job over in Baghdad, not because he was ignorant, it's because he was a skilled craftsman. Halliburton needed a skilled craftsman. They needed at least a journeyman carpenter, and probably a master carpenter. And they got one, and they hired him, and they're paying him $100,000 a year, or more. Plus all of these neat benefits that go with it. Free airfare over and back, and 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. Now, I gotta ask some hard, serious questions here as it relates to the law. But we'll have to do that right after this break. So hang on, Teresa, and we'll be right back. I gotta remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And that The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, these Law Hour programs are an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Alright, we're back. Now let me tell you what the downfall or the downside of hiring an attorney is. When Teresa hired this attorney, she declared herself to be legally incompetent and unable to manage her legal affairs. That's normal. Most people are legal incompetents and unable to manage their affairs. Unfortunately, this puts you into the hands. This is Pearl Pureheart, who is now signing a contract with Oil Can Harry. And Oil Can Harry now has your power of attorney. Now let me show you the temptation that Oil Can Harry has. If in fact Teresa Halliburton were guilty of negligence in this case, which we don't know yet, but if they were, this is called wrongful death, and if you could collect on a wrongful death case, it's probably worth $3 million. Now, Halliburton is on the hook for $3 million, and I saw, we got online the other day, and Halliburton has had 69 of their employees killed over there in Baghdad. I don't know if that's high or low. I don't know if it's normal or abnormal, but they've had 69. Now, you can rest assured, Teresa, that Halliburton took into consideration these wrongful death suits that could occur against them in this war zone. This is a hazardous place to be. And if you're in the Army, you're getting hazardous duty pay for being in Iraq. Or, you know, maybe not Iraq, but Baghdad. Certain areas, they get hazardous duty pay. And you can rest assured that Halliburton has taken that into account. Now, your husband couldn't have gotten a job with Halliburton without a contract. Just like you can't get into the Army without an enlistment contract, Halliburton had your husband sign a contract. And that contract is going to be the governing instrument in any claims for wrongful death. So when your lawyer says you don't have a case, my presumption is you don't have a case. Now, I presume you said here in your letter that you can't collect your husband's death benefits from Social Security until you're 50. That tells me that he's not an employee, because if he was an employee and he got killed on the job, you could get death benefits immediately. For instance, I have a student here who has two teenage boys. His wife was working for a company, and she got cancer and died. He and the two teenagers are collecting $2,000 a month or more in death benefits from Social Security until these boys reach age 21, and he's got something that comes from it. I forgot how much. So Social Security, I can only presume, Teresa, you must have already gone down to Social Security and said, hey, my husband got killed over in Baghdad, and so what am I going to do? And they told you, well, here's what the program is. So I can't second guess Social Security, and I can't second guess Halliburton. I can't second guess your attorney. These are the three people who are already on the job. Now, let's look at it pragmatically. If Halliburton were in fact guilty, would they want to confess and say, gee, we're sorry as hell, we killed your husband, let's just give you $3 million? But they're not going to do that. You're going to have to prove that it was their negligence and that there was, in fact, a wrongful death. And there's a couple of three other factors that came into the equation. For instance, your husband did not practice the law of Moses. He did not practice the law of God. And so I've got to ask the question, Teresa, didn't you and Gene sit down before he left for Baghdad, before he went down and signed up with Halliburton, and didn't you discuss the possibility of going into a war zone and the possibility of getting killed, kidnapped, and beheaded? Because normal, everyday, garden variety, run-of-the-mill people, like you and everybody else that I know of, would have bought a life insurance policy. Didn't you buy a $1 million life insurance policy on your husband before he went to Baghdad? Now, I don't buy insurance and I don't practice limited liability, but your husband didn't have any qualms about working on Saturday, working on the Sabbath day, because he worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So somebody like me couldn't work for Halliburton. You see, I couldn't go down to Houston, Texas and sign on with Halliburton because they require that you work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And since I practice the Sabbath, that precludes me from working for Halliburton in the first place. So I wouldn't even go down and sign up with them. I wouldn't even go down for an interview. I already know the answer. They're not going to let me take off on Saturday. And you can just about rest assured that there aren't any Jews working for Halliburton over there either. People that keep the Sabbath day don't work for those multinational corporations because they practice the law of God to some degree. So since your husband didn't practice the law of God, he didn't keep the Sabbath. If he doesn't keep the Sabbath, he probably doesn't keep the holy days. If he doesn't keep the Sabbaths and holy days, there isn't any reason for him not to have life insurance. So if he didn't have life insurance, then as a doctor would say, he's going naked, you know? And that's a pretty hazardous place. Now, it would seem like to me if I was going over there, and I used to, you know, years ago, you know, I used to be in the construction business, I wouldn't have thought of going over there without a life insurance policy. I wouldn't have even considered it. Because those are hazardous jobs. I mean, if you're going to go out of the country and work on some job and get paid 2, 3, 4, 5 times the amount that you're going to get paid in the States, it's got to be hazardous. You know, otherwise, they'd have all these people that wanted to go work there. All right, so let's tuck that one away. Now, is your lawyer leveling with you, or is your lawyer working for Halliburton? Let me tell you a little story here, because this is pretty common practice. There was an old lawyer by the name of Emil Crow, and he was not only a lawyer, but he was also a claims adjuster. And that's a pretty lucrative field. He was a claims adjuster, an independent claims adjuster down here in the lower tier of counties in Missouri, where I live, as a matter of fact, here in Ozark County, over to the Boot Heel. And in 1950, he took a case on for the Travelers Insurance Company, in which one of their insured had a big policy in 1950, $50,000. I mean, that was god awful big. $10,000 was normal. $20,000, you know, was big. $30,000 was, you know, bigger. $40,000 was bigger yet, and $50,000 was humongous. And this got a $50,000 policy. Well, as it turned out, they analyzed it, Crow analyzed the accident and said, well, we're probably liable for the whole $50,000. If it went to a jury trial, probably more than $50,000. Now, the insurance company is never going to pay more than the policy limit, which is $50,000, but they've got to defend the case in trial, which in those days would probably cost $4,000 or $5,000. So, Emil put in his initial estimate of $50,000 plus. Now, you need to understand, how does the claims adjuster get paid? And he gets paid on commission. He gets paid a percentage of what he saves the company on this claim. Now, he doesn't work for $3 an hour. He works on a percentage. He's going to get 50% of what he saves the company out of this $50,000. So if he could settle a claim for $45,000, the company gets $2,500 of the $5,000 savings, and Crow gets paid $2,500, the other half of the savings. If he can settle a case for $40,000, then he gets $5,000. If he settles a case for $30,000, you know, and so on down the line. Now, you know, the guy already put in, you know, Crow already put in his estimate. He says, hey, this case, if it goes to trial, you guys are going to get crucified. Obviously our guy is guilty, and while nobody was killed, Emil told me, nobody was killed in the accident, lots of hospital bills, long-term permanent disabilities, lifetime permanent disabilities. So, Emil goes into the hospital and he interviews this guy and he says, now, we accept responsibility and our guy is at fault and we're gonna pay you all your hospital bills, and we're just going to take good care of you. And so he got this guy to talking to him and giving him information. This is why your insurance agent always tells you, don't talk about the accident. Shut up. You know, you want to talk to the jury. But anyway, Namel, you know, he's a lawyer and he's a claims adjuster. He goes in and he gets a lot of neat information from this guy. And he strings him out for about 90 days. And now the hospital is after this guy for payment. His car has been wrecked. He's hurt, and his wife is hurt. His kids are all hurt. And he's not working, and the bills are piling up. And this is a part of the insurance company's strategy. See, this is part of Halliburton's strategy. To deal with you as a broke, out of work, incompetent, unable to manage your own affairs, Teresa. Halliburton, multinational corporation with billions of dollars. They can fight you from here to the Supreme Court. They've got the best lawyers that money can buy right on their staff working in their legal department. I mean, you know, this isn't a fair game, Teresa. This is a game that's designed to bury you. Now, a guy by the name of Jerry Spence, you know, spent his life working for the insurance companies and screwing over widows and orphans, and then he changed sides and went to work for the widows and orphans screwing the insurance companies. And he wrote a number of books, and one of them is called With Justice for None. And that's why I read today's ad from Professor Nielsen over here, who says that these lawyers, like this lawyer that you hired over here, you know, he may be totally incompetent. You know, your lawyer may be dumb as a box of rocks. And so, therefore, when Halliburton comes to your lawyer and says, look, you're representing this widow lady over here, and we're on the hook for $3 million. We'll pay you $100,000 to lose the case. We'll pay you $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 to convince her that she doesn't have a case. Which is why I guess you wanted a second opinion, so you called me. But I need to inform you that you're asking me for legal advice, and I can't give you legal advice. It's against the law. See, the legal profession Just like the multinational corporations and the medical profession and the banking profession, see, they carve out these monopolies for themselves. And the legal profession has a monopoly on legal advice. And the only people that can give legal advice are licensed lawyers. Now, I can teach law. I mean, you can go to law school, and I can teach you the law, and then you can go out and you can do battle with Halliburton. But if I'm going to go do battle with Halliburton, I got to be a member of the club. I got to be a dues-paying member of the club. So I'm precluded from giving you legal advice. I mean, I can give you my opinion and say, well, here's what I think, you know, which is what I'm doing. I'm saying, well, you know, here's what I think. So years ago, recognizing this, and I'm telling you this story about Emil Kroh, because Emil wasn't doing anything that's illegal. Emil is an entrepreneur. He goes in, he visits this guy in the hospital, and he gets information from this guy that he's going to use against him. That's Emil's job. I mean, after all, he works for the insurance company. He's not working for this guy that was damaged. The lawyer who's working for Halliburton isn't working for you, Teresa. He's working for Halliburton. There isn't anything that you can say to this guy that's going to help your case. And that's what this guy made a mistake. So he talked to Emil, and Emil got this information. So he strings this guy out for about 90 days, comes in and says, okay, well, I'm authorized to make a settlement. And I'm going to offer you $7,000 because we see contributory negligence. This guy is just livid. Just livid. And he says, I'll sue. I'll go get a lawyer, which is exactly what Emil wants him to do. Because, see, it's difficult for Halliburton to negotiate with you, Teresa. They don't want to negotiate with you. They want to negotiate with your lawyer. And this guy went out and he hired a lawyer. Now, this lawyer that you have, Teresa, is a member of the club. And he's going to go over and negotiate with the Halliburton lawyer who is a member of the club. You say in your letter that when you call Halliburton, they talk to you. Your lawyer says when he calls Halliburton, they won't talk to him. Well, gee, that sends me a pretty strong signal. Your lawyer is working for Halliburton. Now you're sitting there saying, well, no, my lawyer isn't working for Halliburton. I hired my lawyer. He's working for me. No, you don't understand lawyering. You don't understand business. Boys and girls, let's wake up. Smell the coffee. The most money that Teresa could possibly pay her lawyer is $50,000. Didn't you see her letter? She says, I'm broke. I'm scared. They gave me $50,000 and I gotta pay taxes on that. Now, I don't know how much money Teresa's got. Her husband might have been working over there. She might have $200,000 or $300,000 in the bank that we don't know anything about. I don't know. But moral of the story is, if I was the lawyer for Halliburton and I was looking at my case and I said, gee, I got a wrongful death case here, probably going to cost us $2-3 million, I would go to your lawyer and offer him $200,000 or $300,000 to lose, so that I could save $2.7 million for the company. Wouldn't you? I mean, how would you handle that? Is that unethical? Certainly. Is it illegal? Probably. Is it common business? Absolutely. Goes on every day, as evidenced by my old buddy Emil here. But Emil didn't break any laws now. Emil Kroh goes out, and he, old Emil, he starts talking to this guy's attorney. Now, one of the things that that the insurance company guards is the policy limit. You'll never find the policy limit. I'm an old-timey claims adjuster, and I can tell you right now, when I went to claims adjusting school, that's the first thing they taught us. You shut up about the policy limit. Nobody is to know what the ultimate number is we're playing in the game. We don't want the other side to know that we're playing for $50,000. Now, it could well be that there's more information that you need, Teresa, in order to come to a conclusion, and you can't get that from your lawyer because I think your lawyer's working for the other side. That's just my gut reaction here based upon what you tell me. And I can guarantee you that if I was working for Halliburton, that's what I'd be doing. I'd be calling your lawyer and saying, hey, let's negotiate a settlement. We need a settlement. So Emil Crow negotiates with the lawyer, and he tells the other side, he says, well, the policy limit's 20,000. What's the real policy limit? It's 50. But he tells the other side it's 20. And now, in order to negotiate a settlement, you got to leave something on the table. So he suggests to the other side that they settle at 17,000 and that they leave 3,000 on the table and that they avoid going to trial. So this guy's lawyer now, he goes to this guy and he says, listen, they offered you 7. I got them up to nearly the policy limit. If we take the case to trial, we'll probably win and we'll probably get 20,000. We can settle out of court and you don't need to go to trial, and we can settle for 17. Got to leave a little something on the table for the other side. And so the guy settled at 17, and he actually left 33 on the table. Now, here's what happened. The victim, his wife and his children, after they pay their lawyer one-third of the 17,000 now, ends up with about 12,000, doesn't he? His lawyer gets 6,000. And then Emil Crow divides the other 33,000, that's $17,000 each, or 16,500 each, for Emil and the insurance company. So the insurance company and Emil Crow actually come out of this deal better off than the victim. And the lawyer for the other side, he comes up with $6,000 for negotiating the settlement. And that's very common practice, very common practice. I can't tell you how many people I've had come through school over the years that have been involved in those kind of deals. Teresa, you can go negotiate your own settlement if you knew how. A guy by the name of Winkey over here wrote a book, you know, called The Art of Negotiation, which we teach here in law school. So here's getting back now to my earlier suggestion. Yeah, I could go out and help one person at a time build a house. And I think that if I had a couple of helpers working, I could probably build one house every 90 days. If I had two good, strong, healthy carpenters, skilled people. And as a general contractor, I went down to the Gulf Coast, I could build 4 houses a year. My God, we need thousands and thousands of houses. So I'll tell you what I could do. I could open a carpentry school, and I think I could turn out good, skilled carpenters at the rate of 100 to 200 a year. I think I could actually train 100 to 200 carpenters a year. Which is what I do here in law school. I can take a Teresa and I can turn her into a lawyer. It's called a pro se litigant for herself. And then she can go do her own legal research. She can take that same contract that her husband signed at Halliburton, and she can code plead the contract out and come to the conclusion. You don't need to pay a lawyer $5,000 or $10,000 to read a contract and say you don't have a case. You can read the contract yourself if you knew what to be looking for or how to read, how to code plead it out, and come to the conclusion, I don't have a case, and save the $10,000. That's my point. So I've discovered that, and I learned this from an old country lawyer who taught me. I didn't go to law school. I was taught by an old country lawyer, the way they used to teach lawyers, you know, before we had law schools. We've had lawyers for a long time. We've had lawyers longer than we've had law schools. In fact, the Apostle Paul was trained at the feet of Gamaliel. He was tutored by a law school, a law professor. That's what I do. I have adopted the same procedure, the same process called tutoring. Just like instead of going to some college over here, you know, that's going to teach you little or nothing. I'll tell you right now, if you want to be a carpenter, you just go apprentice yourself to a carpenter, a general contractor. Just walk out to a general contractor and tell him, hey, I'll work for you free. I just want to learn how to be a carpenter. He'll hire you right on. And in 90 days, he'll train you to be a carpenter. And if you can't make it in 90 days, the carpenter isn't your business. You shouldn't be in that train. Just get out there and roll up your sleeves and go to work. And the same thing is true in law. It's been my experience. Same thing is true everywhere. Now, this fellow Gene had an angel. Did you know that all of us have guardian angels? They're spoken of in the Bible. And they protect you. What happened to Gene's guardian angel? Well, Gene's guardian angel did not protect him from time and chance. See, time and chance happens to us all, except those of us that obey God, keep His commandments, and practice the Mosaic law. Then you're under the contract. You're under the law. Under the protection of the contract. Satan took Jesus up on top of the pinnacle of the temple. You'll see this in Matthew chapter 4, about verse 6 or so. And he said, throw yourself down. Your angel will bury you up. Jesus never contradicted him. He said, no, you can't do that. That's tempting God. That's against the law. Had this fellow Gene been obeying the law, had Gene been a practitioner of the Sabbaths and holy days, etc., he wouldn't have been in Baghdad to start with. But then he wouldn't be making $100,000 a year either. So the temptation was, Halliburton came to Gene and he said, look, if you'll break the Sabbath and break the holy days and come to work for us in Baghdad, we will pay you 5 times what you can make over here in the States. And Gene said, yeah, I will break the law of God. I will violate the law of God to make that kind of money. You know, that's the temptation that goes on in life every day. That's the temptation. Break the law, and you get this neat benefit. Break the law, and you can sleep with this foxy chick tonight. You know, we all look at that foxy chick and say, God, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to sleep with that foxy chick. And then you wake up one day, and you've got VD, and you say, well, gee, did I get VD from that foxy chick? Probably. 25% of high school kids today in our high schools have sexually transmitted diseases. Were they born with sexually transmitted diseases? Where did they get those diseases? Didn't they get them from practicing free sex? Didn't they get them from sex education class in public school, where they taught them there's no absolutes and you don't want to practice abstinence and you do want to go out and experiment and have fun with sex, don't you, at age 14? And then when your 14 or 15 or 16-year-old girl gets knocked up, you know, you say, oh, I just can't understand what happened. Yeah, boys and girls, I mentioned this to you on the last program. I said, you know, if we didn't break a lot of these laws, we wouldn't have nearly the bad results that we're getting. If Gene hadn't violated many of these laws, he would still be alive. But, you know, these are decisions that people have to make. And I don't know whether going to Baghdad's a good idea or a bad idea. I just think that if you go to Baghdad and you're going to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you're not going to practice the Sabbath, you're not going to practice the holy days, you're not going to practice the law of God, well, then what the hell difference does it make if you violate another law called strict liability? You should have an insurance policy. Now, I don't practice insurance, and I practice the Mosaic Law, so therefore I can't work for Halliburton, so therefore I can't make the big money, so that's why I'm just a poor old country law school teacher. But there's the story. And yes, Teresa, you can determine whether or not you've got a case, but I can't make that determination for you, and I haven't got enough information here to make that determination, so... We're just about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, of course, right here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So let me give you a reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.